Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello. So, we have quite a lot to speak about, to say the least, with our two brilliant guests today. We've got the incredible Yanis Varoufakis, who I think you will, if you don't know who Yanis is, what's the point really at this point? Former Greek finance minister, economist, author, lots of hats. Raul Martinez also has lots of hats. Brilliant writer, author. Actually, as well, they're both collaborating at the moment on a great series called In the Eye of the Storm, the political odyssey of Yanis Varoufakis, which I just can imagine is set in the future. Which I've always thought, actually, Yanis Varoufakis was kind of set in the future and has sort of travelled back in time to impart his wisdom. But they've also started a brilliant podcast called Eye of the Storm with some of the world's leading thinkers and artists. So we are going to talk about that. I'm going to start, though. I have to say, Yanis, I'm going to have to obviously start by talking to you about the latest instalments of the political dystopia we currently find ourselves in. Now, this is related to what happened at the Palestine Congress in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I've actually already interviewed Yudi Raz, who is a Jewish activist who was arrested that day. And just so we're clear about why he was arrested, he was wearing his kippah, his Jewish skull cap. A German police officer was pointing at it and laughing. Yudi Raz accused him of being anti-Semitic in doing so. And then the police officer arrested him on the basis that was causing offense to a police officer, dragged him away. And then he and Yudi Raz and everybody else there were obviously smeared with anti-Semitism, as well as being Islamists by the German government. Yanis Varoufakis, due to speak there, was then banned from Germany and banned from all political activity, including doing videos. So not even being in Germany, just doing like a speech. Can you just explain what the hell is going on here?
Look, when the surreal replaces the real by the order of the Ministry of the Interior, it's very difficult to explain what on earth is going on. But I think that you gave us a very good example of a German policeman arresting a Jew for anti-Semitism. That's the definition of surrealism. A few months earlier, another colleague of ours, a member of the same organization, the very well-known and brilliant Jewish voice for a just peace, a German Jewish organization, Iris Heifetz. Iris Heifetz is an Israeli Jew. She lives in Berlin and she practices psychoanalysis, and she decided to perform a one-woman protest on her street just outside, you know, her residence. So she walked on the street on her own without anybody around her, carrying a little placard in which she said she had written with her own handwriting, "As an Israeli and as a Jew, stop the genocide in Gaza." And German police arrested her for anti-Semitism. So compared to this absurdity, what they did to me was just a misdemeanor. Of course, it does have very serious repercussions because, Owen, to this day, my lawyers in Germany have been demanding of the state a written statement of who decided my being banned from Germany, when is the ban still valid, and what is the rationale of the ban. After lots of phone calls and emails, they emailed back to my lawyer, a brilliant activist lawyer. They sent him a letter addressed to me, which said that, "Mr. Varoufakis, within 48 hours, you will have a written response to your questions." 48 hours later, we got another email saying, it was a two-page letter to me explaining why there wouldn't be a response. And the explanation effectively amounted to saying that if they were to disclose to me who decided to ban me, when and why, that would have severe repercussions for the capacity of the Federal Republic of Germany to collaborate with intelligence services, of meaning, of course, foreign intelligence services, in order to minimize the threats that the Federal Republic of Germany faces. I don't think I need to add anything more, except my brief comment that this is, of course, the end of any pretense to democracy, to the rule of law, when you're being accused essentially of terrorism or of supporting terror or trivializing terrorism, because this is what has been published in every German newspaper. And you don't have the opportunity to see what the rationale is or to challenge your accuser or to find out who your accuser is. And also, it is the end of the European Union. I am a citizen of a member state of the European Union. I was a candidate. I was myself a candidate, a German candidate in the European Union election, parliament elections in 2019. I gathered 135,000 votes, which is not completely insignificant. You know, 135,000 citizens of the Federal Republic of Germany voted for me. The party I belong to, Mera 25, is running in Germany, in Greece, in Italy, but also in Germany. And I'm not allowed even to zoom in to a meeting in the Federal Republic of Germany, for reasons that will not be disclosed to me, because the Federal Republic of Germany feels that its national security will be jeopardized if I find out who accused me. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying that the surreal has essentially colonized the real.
I mean, before I ask both you and Raoul about this visit to Berlin recently, I just want to get your thought on this, Yanis, in terms of this is nominally a country run by two centre-left, but I don't really know what centre-left means, really, to be honest. It's one of these terms thrown around that no one's ever given me a working definition. But nonetheless, the Social Democrats and the Greens are supposed to be progressive parties. They're in coalition, obviously, with the centre-right party, the Free Democrats. But nonetheless, this isn't a formerly right-of-centre government overall. The AfD, the far-right, are on the march. If this is happening now, this level of authoritarianism, an entire Congress, a free meeting being shut down, people gathering, using their rights of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, including stopping a British-Palestinian doctor from entering the country altogether, barring you, arresting Jewish activists, I keep saying it, watching German police officers dragging off Jewish activists wearing their kippah, doesn't sit well with me, just triggers a certain emotion, doesn't it? If that's happening now, what's going to happen? In terms of the political movements in Germany and elsewhere, if we're already at this stage under Social Democrats and Greens?
Well, it's already spreading, isn't it? A few days after my ban in Germany, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who scored more than 20% of the vote in the last presidential election in France, he was barred from entering a university and delivering a speech about Palestine along with members of parliament. That was in Paris. Since then, there have been numerous reports of candidates from his party being banned from delivering speeches, from attending meetings. Theaters were cancelling bookings for the party. And allow me to make a broader point. This is not some craze that simply has taken over those who are ruling Germany, the center-left, as you put it, or indeed in France. It's been a long way coming. Remember that the very harsh austerity that was introduced across Europe did not begin in Greece in 2010. It began in 2008. 2008, 2009, in Germany, and it was spearheaded by the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, when they were in government together with the Christian Democrats. But it was the Social Democratic, the equivalent of the British Labour Party, finance minister, Mr. Steinbrück, who actually gave a long speech as to why austerity is necessary for democracy. So if you combine that with the ill effects of austerity on the majority of the Germans, because, you know, 50 to 60% of Germans today are worse off today than they were 20 years ago. So you mentioned the inexorable rise of the ultra-right, the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD. Well, those things go together. So you've got the center-left adopting the policies of the right, creating discontent, which then feeds the ultra-right. Now, where is Palestine coming into this? Well, it's my considered opinion. This is quite speculative, but it is my view that around the end of the 1980s, sometime in the 1990s, the impossibility of having a legitimate nationalist or patriotic even German ideological glue for the Federal Republic of Germany, especially after reunification, because of the Holocaust, because of the awful crimes committed against the Jews, but not only against the Jews, caused a shift. The whole system of power in the Federal Republic, having shed nationalism because it was unsustainable after the Second World War, they adopted an ultra-Zionism, saying, allow me to make a little bit of a joke here. In the same way that Thatcher privatized electricity in Britain and effectively sold it to a nationalized French company. So, you know, their own nation nationalized Britain's electricity. Similarly, in Germany, have a foreign, a Zionist nationalism, a Zionist white settler mentality being instead of the homegrown German nationalism in order to bring together the political center, the center left, the center right. And that fed into the great inroads of the ultra right.
I think that's very perceptive. I mean, Raoul, by the way, I should also say Raoul is obviously a writer, is an award-winning filmmaker, which is relevant partly to the trailer I'm about to show as well. But before I do just bring in terms of just show the trailer, Raoul, I'm just interested in your thoughts, because I was just saying yesterday, actually, I saw this, I think an American professor or some American kind of right-wing thinker who says, he just tweeted out about the faculty members of New York University creating a ring around the Gaza Solidarity encampment to protect their students. And then they retweeted it, dear NYPD, please, please, please arrest these faculty members. And I just tweeted, have you noticed how talk of cancel culture and free speech on campus and there was no right to be offended and ridiculed of safe spaces ended after 7th of October, which it did, by the way. No one's talking about cancel culture anymore, have you noticed? Because the people who were talking about cancel culture, the people now trying to cancel everyone who stands in support of Palestine. That's exactly what happened, by the way. People haven't really sort of noticed this properly yet, but they should. But I'm just interested because, you know, I think the world will look back at this period and see the world on its head in the abstract, which is a genocidal onslaught against the people of Gaza and the people who are being persecuted and silenced and arrested and deplatformed and all the rest are the people who oppose the mass slaughter, including in Germany, disproportionately Jewish people who have been targeted, but also minorities, particularly. I mean, a gay Iranian German got in touch with me. He'd fled Iran as a refugee, worked in a shop in Germany, back to ceasefire. Non-Jewish Germans suddenly were calling him racist terms in Islamist, go back to your shithole country, trying to force him to put the Israeli flag on his door. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. But what do you just think about this, the way that this kind of basically an attempt to intimidate and silence, and what's driving it, do you think? Because I think partly they're morally disgraced and they know it, and they also know that this movement has won public opinion and that's going to have consequences. So that's why they're, including in Germany, I'd say.
I mean, absolutely, Owen. I think, you know, we're living through a period of intense war propaganda. And the more unforgivable the action, the more intense the propaganda has to be to control the population, to encourage support of horrific violence, or very often simply to distract people away or scare people into silence, which I think we've seen many, many examples of. Years ago, I did a documentary called The Lottery of Birth, and the book I wrote explored this idea in some depth. And for me, it's a powerful idea because it really it encourages us to focus on the ways in which human beings can be conditioned across a whole spectrum of behavior. We can be conditioned to embrace the most irrational and the most awful forms of human behavior imaginable. And we see throughout history every kind of example. And we can be conditioned to do beautiful things and contribute peace and beauty and truth to society. And what we're seeing now, I think, are the awful outcomes, the awful result of many decades of conditioning, which brings out the worst, which is designed specifically to polarize human beings and to encourage us to view the world through the lens of national, ethnic, and religious identities, which blinds us to the foundational truth that every person on this planet is a brother and a sister, that we're so much more similar than we are different. And these identities which we are encouraged, which we are conditioned to identify with on men intellectually, emotionally, they distort our perception of reality, and they make us potentially a dangerous force in the world and easier to manipulate. So that's what I see is really this: we've learned the wrong lesson from history. You know, the lesson is about conditioning, the dangers of conditioning. Mm-hmm. So we end up not seeing each other for what we are, which is human beings with beautiful potential and dangerous potential.
Which is exactly what the work you're doing now is trying to push. So let's just have a look at this trailer, and then we'll have a little talk about it.
Debt is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Unpleasant and essential.
We are in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
The sacrifices of the Greek people will bring the country back to prosperity.
The 2008 crisis was not one of the normal periodic downturns. It is the longest damage-inducing crisis in the history of capitalism. I could feel that the tsunami was coming, the result being the modern world that we live in. We were negotiating with financial terrorism, creditors who did not want their money back. Every asset of the Greek state was bundled together. This was a hidden bailout, and we were collateral damage.
They want our properties, they want our homeland.
Austerity is another term for class war.
Orchestrated attempt of economic aggression. It cannot be described in any other way.
I could see Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, getting very agitated. He gets the floor. Elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. It became a massive battle to prevent the public ever from finding out.
I've never listened to such an inaccurate report.
This is what an oligarchy does when an oligarchy gets threatened. Like David and Goliath, they had to get rid of him. The landline rings. If you want your son to continue to return safely every night, you better lay off. And he mentioned a particular bank.
We're being dragged into a labyrinth.
They had to find ways of violating their own rules.
It is Wall Street who's our enemy.
Our regulators became enablers.
All you can talk about is fairy tales of economic growth.
Anybody who tells you economics is a science is either a fool or is trying to fool you.
We have seen an almost Newtonian revolution in the science of economics.
It takes a small spark to ignite a revolutionary moment. Either we move beyond capitalism or we die.
Oof, chills. Excellent stuff. Very excited about this. Also, just watching that, it's quite interesting just because there's not been enough films made about just the period we've lived through, this very discombobulating, intense age, I would say. Before I just ask Raoul about making this film, I just want to ask, sorry, Yanis, again, not to just keep revisiting traumas here, but because you both went to launch a docuseries in Berlin, And then to find out that the owner of the cinema, who is Jewish, and this is always relevant because, again, this the number of German Jews who come under pressure is just, I mean, history will, again, I think, be pretty damning. But or including from the police to cancel the event because of your stance on Gaza. And the owner stood firm, but there was a security guard hired for the Q&A because of threats made against Yanis. Sounds pretty tense, if I'm honest, Yanis.
It is, isn't it? You know, I never imagined that I would live such moments in Berlin. And as a kid, I grew up in a fascist dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all those events that you're describing now and reminding me of, just take me back to, you know, when I was an 8, 9, 10 year old. And I remember in the middle of winter, my parents, who were very worried about relatives, my own father who had been in prison, but others who were still in prison. And they wanted to hear news about, you know, what's happening with our regime, because of course there was no way of finding out through our own media. Yeah. And I remember what I call our red blanket days, my mom and dad huddling together under a red blanket in the middle of their living room with a shortwave radio, trying to listen to Deutsche Welle. And the reason why they were doing that was banned to listen to Deutsche Welle. And we had very nosy snitches living nearby. So they were trying to muffle the sound of Deutsche Welle. For me, Deutsche Welle, as a kid, you know, that Deutsche Welle is the BBC of Germany. Was, you know, the voice of democracy, the voice of freedom. For me, Germany was a mythical place out there that were our friends. And to experience those scenes in Berlin only recently, in the launch of Raoul's documentary. By the way, this documentary is Raoul. You may see
it. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I know. It's just I see you just collaborating together. But of course, this is Raoul. You were there just making directing a film, so, to be fair. But I should be clear, this is Raoul's brilliant film, just so everyone's aware of it. Carry on, sorry.
It's film. I'm just there as a talking head. It is absurd. And I feel very peeved and saddened by what's happening to the German people, because I have a very strong connection with the German people since I was a very young person. And they're again being dragged onto a very hazardous road to a heartless society in which a new kind of German McCarthyism is preventing them from resisting this passage to yet another situation where they are being complicit to a genocide against their interests, but in their name.
And just people, I don't know, maybe a certain younger generation weren't aware of what Yanis was referring to there. He meant the colonels, the junta that ruled Germany from 67 to 74. Horrible. Yeah, hideous regime in Greece, which was backed obviously by the West.
The CIA, it was engineered by the CIA and NATO. This is another reason when people say to me that, you know, unless Ukraine is a member of NATO, they cannot be a democracy. I grew up in a NATO member state, which was a fascist dictatorship. So, you know, I have lots of question marks about the official version of events today everywhere around Europe.
And of course, that people are often up in terms of Britain, not to our history, in terms of the role of the British, obviously after World War II in Germany and the brutal counterinsurgency offensive, which Britain was involved in. But unfortunately, all of Britain's dark history is generally erased. Raoul, so yes, let's be clear, the artistic genius behind this masterpiece, it looks absolutely incredible. Very, very excited about it. So just tell me, what made you think, we've got to do this? This is the series we've got to make.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yeah, well, look, I think it goes back to the financial crisis of 2008 and seeing how the language of economics was weaponized, the burden of that crisis on many millions of people who played no part in creating it, particularly with the language of austerity. And I saw how powerful this was. And also just more generally, how the language of economics is used to cordon off the most important decisions, really, in our polity. And say, no, these are technical decisions to be made by a small class of experts. And to the extent you succeed in doing that, you remove the demos from democracy and the fact that you end up with an illusion of choice. And so I had this impetus. I wanted to do a documentary that could somehow provide people with a framework that would empower them to make sense of these control mechanisms. And around that time, I had the privilege of being invited to a private event where Yanis was speaking. And he was talking about market failures, GDP, various technical aspects of economics, but he had the audience in the palm of his hand and he was making everyone laugh and he's incredibly engaging. And for me, that was the beginning. That was a seed of the idea because I recognized Yanis's profound gift for communication, his deep understanding of these matters. And then I went and investigated in more depth his story, his journey going from intellectual to politician, finance minister. And I thought this is just an inherently dramatic story, that it's a microcosm of dynamics which we're all experiencing at a global level, where with the rise of Syriza in Greece, you have this remarkable moment, this powerful example of what happens when crisis creates an opportunity. You know, very often we all want change, we're all fighting for change in society if we're progressives. But the window of opportunity opens up hugely in these moments of crisis. And in Greece, it sort of went further, really, than in the UK, we had Jeremy Corbyn, in the US, we had Bernie Sanders. But in Greece, the left actually came to power, inverted commas, power. We'll see how much power they actually had in the story. But they came to office, at least. And I think learning the lessons from these moments of opportunity and crisis are incredibly important for the left, particularly because the history immediately gets rewritten by the powerful. And that stops us learning the lessons of what went right and what went wrong. So a fair bit of the documentary series, and it started out as a documentary feature, a single feature, but the interview with Yanis was so rich that it expanded to a 6-part series. So it explores Yanis's journey as a politician, intellectual, finance minister. But then it goes on actually to expand its scope, to look internationally at the dynamics which are driving the various crises that we're living through economically in terms of ecology and climate change and the broader dynamics of capitalism. But I have to say what really I think holds the whole series together is Yanis's personal human story. The fact that, you know, I often quote Tony Benn saying that the most powerful word in politics is no. And Yanis is a really powerful example of someone who, when it really counted, when it really mattered, he had the courage and integrity to say no to the Troika, to some of the most powerful institutions of capitalism. And so the series is a combination of these elements, the human, the intellectual, the micro and the macro. So yeah, that's the motivation.
That quote that for Milton Friedman, which, the right-wing economist, but only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces a real change when that crisis occurs. The actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around, and kind of you're tapped into that idea. Often like to quote enemies on things when they're being very perceptive, as they are there. And before I ask you, I want to ask about art there and how that has an impact. I mean, Yanis, just, you know, because I guess it gives you an opportunity, this, to just reflect on this age in which we live. Because at the moment, what happens is, I guess it often feels when you're operating in this environment as a public figure, public intellectual, it's kind of you're lurching from one crisis to another, doing lots of different interventions. But, you know, just to be able to take a step back and look at everything. And I just wonder, actually, again, quoting from the right, it's sometimes said by the American right, I don't know who said this, but Barry Goldwater was a right-wing Republican candidate who lost in a landslide in 1964 to LBJ and stood on a kind of right-wing platform, which was then rejected, basically. But it was sometimes said about Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980 that Barry Goldwater won. It just took 16 years to count the votes. And what I mean by that, and it's interesting because, you know, Raul said, you said no, and the Greek people also said no in a referendum, of course, on the Troika, but their verdict was overturned. But I'm just wondering, Yanis, looking back at this, I sometimes think this is like a first wave of the new left. And you could see the kind of, you know, Podemos in Spain, Bernie Sanders in the United States, Jeremy Corbyn here, you know, various other kind of movements that emerged, obviously Syriza in Greece. And it looks like we kind of like laid the foundations that now we have lots of kind of ideas which we didn't have before, because the left was very on the defensive and defined by what it was against, not what it was for, after, you know, the kind of defeats of the 1980s, I'd say. That's changed. You've got a whole politicized level of youth, I would say, not in all countries, in Italy. Things aren't looking good for young people. In France, it's a mixed bag. But you do have a more politicized group of people. And I just wonder, you know, having been involved in one of those waves in Greece, and still are, but having an international kind of platform, what do you think? Was this our first wave, and actually the next wave will be better prepared?
Well, I hope so. This is why we are still in politics. This is why I'm still in politics, Owen, because... as you say, and as Milton Friedman correctly said, the way I see it, allow me a surfer's paradigm or paradigm metaphor. These rebellions are generated by the very extractive system that we live in. Call it capitalism, I call it techno-feudalism these days, it doesn't matter. It's an extractive system which produces greater and deeper crisis from the same production line that it produces iPhones or whatever it is, you know, industrial robots. So these rebellions are a natural phenomenon, a natural repercussion of the system we live in, and they come in waves. So like good surfers, we cannot create the wave. But what we must do, we must be prepared with our ideas, with our narratives, with our policies, to catch the next wave. In 2008, which was the greatest shock to the capitalist system since 1929, in my estimation, it was even bigger of a shock than 1929. But that's neither here nor there. We of the left, internationally, were not ready for it. And we didn't catch the wave. We tried, occupy Wall Street, occupy the city of London, the Indignados in Spain that then gave rise to Podemos, the Aganaktismeni here in Athens that gave rise to Syriza. You're absolutely right about that. But I must say that there is a profound asymmetry between the Milton Friedmans and the Goldwaters and so on and us of the left. Mm-hmm. And the asymmetry has to do with money and power. So when, you know, Milton Friedman used to be a charlatan, he was shunned by the establishment. His ideas in the 1950s, especially in the 1960s, were denigrated by the very establishment, which after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the early 1970s embraced him. But it didn't just happen because he had ideas lying around the floor. He had huge resources. The Mont Pelerin Society, industrialists like the Koch brothers and so on, they were providing for huge quantities of money, media cover, think tanks that with a lot of researchers provide, you know, churning out data that was manipulated in order to provide backing for the monstrous ideas behind monetarism and Thatcherism and Reaganism and so on. We don't have these resources. Instead, unlike Reagan, who was a class warrior, or Thatcher, who defended the bourgeoisie that put her there to the hilt and was a remarkable class warrior on the other side, our side, when we got an opportunity here in Greece in 2015, we blew it. And we blew it because essentially our leadership surrendered. They were co-opted. The system proved too powerful, too rich, and too much of a lure to the individuals in our midst, and they took us over, essentially. And once our government here surrendered, Podemos was dust. Die Linke in Germany was dust. You folks in the United Kingdom with Jeremy, you put up a little bit of a fight. The 2017 general election was a magnificent result, as far as I'm concerned. I was there in Britain with you folks, and I basked in that very short-lived glory. But then immediately after that, they found a way of undermining it. So there is an asymmetry. We don't have the resources that the bourgeoisie, the ruling class have, and therefore we must be better prepared and we must be more united and more solidaristic with one another.
I mean, Raoul, just a couple of other things. I mean, in terms of, I mean, firstly, you've got this new podcast series called The Eye of the Storm, and it's just like a media empire here being born, which I'm thoroughly enjoying all these new media empires, Media Sound with ZTO, which I've been very proud to be taking part in. But I'm just interested, tell me, you know, because this is about engaging with some of the world's leading thinkers and artists. I'm interested just, kind of what's, you know, is that kind of trying to, what's the aim there? Is it to try and kind of knit it together? And I'm interested because, you know, you're of an artistic disposition, just how art and politics, how that, you know, how they go together.
Yeah, well, look, I think we need more art in our politics and more politics in our art generally. And that's a sort of guiding principle for me in my own work. The podcast is an excuse, an opportunity for Yanis and myself to explore more deeply the themes of the documentary series. And I hope over the course of the podcast, with the many conversations we're having with, you know, truly incredible thinkers, beautiful people, that we can knit together a framework which can empower people to make more sense of the reality that we're living through, which is a very disorientating reality. But in terms of the power of art, I mean, I think of it in terms of our perceptual environment. And our perceptual environment is saturated with content designed to manipulate, to misinform, to distract, and to polarize. And that leaves most of us disorientated and isolated, isolated from each other and also isolated from parts of ourselves. I think art can do the opposite. I see true art as profoundly nourishing, nourishing on an emotional level, on an intellectual level, even on a spiritual level. And that's what I see as a power of art. It connects us, it reconnects us to parts of ourselves and to truth, to reality, and to other people. So, in terms of diet, it's about shifting our diet. And I think, Owen, you know, I don't know if you regard what you do as artistic per se, but I think your contribution with your channel over these months, I just want to say, has been immensely important. And particularly in a media landscape, which is just barren. It's really shown itself up in recent months. Barren in terms of just humanity and commitment to basic principles of journalism and truth. And so, you know, in this landscape, at this point in our history, we need independent media, we need independent discussions, and I think we need art to play a role in reconnecting us and hopefully inspiring us to think beyond the present moment, you know, cultivate our imaginations, not be stuck within the existing parameters, and give us the courage and the energy to act on shifting course. That's what I see as, you know, the potential of art.
Very beautifully put. Just finally, Alice, let's end, because I'm very excited about this, and I'm sure everyone's going to check this out and spread the word, as I'm sure they will. You know what? I just look at the moment. I'm speaking later to an academic at Columbia University, Jewish academic, and we can see at the moment how, I say that because there's this huge attempt to demonize those protesters at Columbia University who are protesting, obviously, against a genocidal war in Gaza. And it's just, you know, you see at the moment mass graves being uncovered. And, you know, something I said yesterday is that you know you're living through a crime of historic proportions when two words in the English language are put together, mass graves. There's a clue there, isn't there, really? Throughout history, that's one of your biggest red flags. But, you know, you're seeing, obviously, the reason you're seeing this attempt to demonize those who are standing against one of the great crimes of our age is because of the sheer level of obscenity. It's impossible to suppress. They know they've lost public opinion. And we mentioned Germany, McCarthyism, but the polling shows this, that most Germans, a large proportion, oppose Israel's onslaught on Gaza. And they know there's going to be consequences for them and for the positions that they hold. And, you know, what your work here is doing as an example is tapping into that. People have a thirst for it because, you know, we've rarely seen such a collision between the media, where the media's at, and where people are at. I mean, Gaza really sums that up. I'm just wondering that, you know, bearing with your project in mind, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I look at these younger people and they're not taking any shit. They grew up in a world defined by a failed economic model and catastrophic foreign wars, all of them catastrophic on their own terms and on the terms of the impact on humanity. And the response to younger people who are saying, we grew up with this and it is bullshit. It is hideous bullshit. We suffer the consequences and we are watching depravity every single day. And we're going to fight back. And the response is just to go for them, demonize them, make them to be this demonic, evil mob, turning the world upside down. But it gives hope, doesn't it, Yanis? Because I just think you look at this and you just think, well, actually, after the age in which we've lived with all these defeats, but there are people who, you know, that generation, I just think they're not going to take it anymore. Again, to quote American right wing, we're mad and we're not going to take it anymore. What do you think? This moment actually does give a lot of hope amidst horrible despair.
It's what keeps me smiling. I was reading today the headlines, Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, one headline, gung-ho, wonderful that the US Senate passed a bill giving $96 billion dollars to three war zones, essentially. Two that are active, one in Ukraine, another in Gaza to Israel, and a third to Taiwan, fomenting war there in the Pacific. That would be even more horrendous than what we already have. So the whole establishment in Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, they're celebrating the fact that almost $100 billion is going to be spent yesterday on more war. And yet you have young people, you can see the proliferation of protests across the United States. These are not guided by anything. These are spontaneous demonstrations. It reminds the older ones of the manner in which the establishment in Washington, but also in Europe, lost control of the youth in the mid-60s. As a result of the anti-war protests against Vietnam. In a sense, I said that on the day, on the 7th of October, and of course I was an ambassador for that, but there is a parallel between the Hamas attack on the wall, the wall, effectively the barbed wire of the concentration camp, also known as the Gaza Strip, with the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, which was a desperate offensive. It yielded lots of deaths. There was a lot of cruelty, but nevertheless, that changed the narrative and created this student movement in the United States, which then spread and also gave rise to the May of 1968 across Europe. So yes, I get a lot of, the only source of hope, but a lot of it, a very rich source of hope from the youth, from the students, especially in the United States, where, you know, everything begins there in the same way that under the Roman Empire, everything began, you know. But Owen, can I just say one thing about Raoul, because it hasn't been said, and because you made the point about art. Yeah. You can, you know, he's a painter. He's a very accomplished painter. You can see, you can look at his portraits in the National Portrait Library, gallery in London. And I'm saying that because, you know, you asked about art, and what sticks to my mind is, you know, Picasso's comment about Guernica, that, yeah, which is of course the painting of a massacre from the Spanish Civil War. And you remember what he said, that paintings are not for decorating rooms or museums or galleries. They're instruments of war, sometimes defensive, sometimes offensive. So that's how I see his documentary.
Well, I'm extremely excited about the documentary, and I think everybody who's listened to both of you so speak so eloquently and so beautifully. I mean, there's always a huge amount of humanity in the works of both of you. And I think this, you know, we do need to take stock of everything we just lived through. And this is such a brilliant way of doing it, such an engaging way of doing it, which makes a lot of often quite complex ideas very accessible, which is always something I'm very fond of, and the podcast as well. So it's a big honor, but I'm very excited about it. So Eye of the Storm, make sure you can go, everyone, now. It's just been released, 80 countries it's been viewed in. Go to eyeofthestorm.info, but I'll put that in the description so everyone will be able to see that anyway, as soon as they click on this. So, but make sure you click on it and spread the word. Very excited. Do you share this video as well? Leave your comments. Love to hear your thoughts. Press the like button, subscribe. But Yanis and Raoul, very excited about the new project, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking such huge risks with the stance you are taking regarding Palestine.
Well, as I'm sure I speak for all of us, I'd never forgive myself if I did anything else, but thank you.
But not everybody else is doing their duty.
I've noticed. Yeah, I've noticed. And I'll just say, I'll never forgive them, just so we're absolutely clear about that and put that on record. Anyway.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.